The chimes in Altgeld Hall are an important tradition of the University of Illinois. Today they're heard not only on the quadrangle and along the Elmarched Broadwalk, but throughout the state as the university celebrates its 83rd birthday. You, its friends and alumni, are invited to join our tape-recorded celebration as we recall some of the important achievements of these past 83 years. For this is the story of a statewide campus. March 1868. Spring came in like a lion, and the prairie wind roared over a bleak and unadorned campus made up of muddy lanes and surrounded by pasture. Three faculty members stood on the steps of a lonely building waiting to greet 15-year-old James Newton Matthews, the first student to enter the Illinois Industrial University. The bleak building was the only building which the university boasted at that time. The two top floors served as a dormitory for the entire student body, a grand total of 77. They ate, slept, went to class, and held all of their religious and social activities in that one building which was dubbed the Elephant. Each student brought with him his own bed, bedding, and stove. Coal had to be purchased from the alma mater, but the price was included in the $4 per semester, which provided for the rooms and furnishings. The original plan for the university looked toward a school for the great mass of working people in Illinois, rather than for the privileged few. And the students were to get practical as well as theoretical training. According to the Land Grant Act of 1862, schools receiving land grant properties must offer studies in agriculture, mechanical arts, and military training, without excluding other scientific and classical studies. This last phrase aroused a good deal of criticism. All right, ma'am.
My boy pays $15 a year for tuition at this university, and he pays it to learn something practical about farming, not a lot of dead languages.
And you, sir?
Well, I agree with the lady. The citizens of this state want to see courses taught which will have a direct practical value in agriculture and industry. We feel that there's no place for such courses as literature and languages.
The university's first regent, John Milton Gregory, held another view, however.
Education must fit for society and citizenship, as well as for science and industry. This is to be a university, not merely a technical school.
John Milton Gregory served as regent for 13 difficult and harassing years. He resigned his post in 1880. However, he wanted to remain a part of the university, and one of his last requests was to be buried on the campus. The marker on his grave bears an epitaph which daily becomes more meaningful. If you seek his monument, look about you. For John Milton Gregory was the guiding hand which set the University of Illinois on its course as a statewide campus, and the university itself as a monumental tribute to his work. In 1885, the Illinois Industrial University became the University of Illinois. This was the era of gas lights and unpaved streets. Football was played in derby hats, and the student newspaper, the Illini, referred to baseball as the activity of those left behind in the race for oratorical and literary honors. Tug-of-war contests were part of the athletic program and usually ended with the losers being dragged through the boneyard. The horse-drawn streetcar went out around 1893, the same year Illinois got its first football band. Two drums, four brasses, and a fife. This was a far cry from the expert group which John Philip Sousa later acclaimed the greatest college band in the world. Well, the campus was growing in size and services. The Chicago Professional Schools were established in 1896 as a part of the university. And in 1914, the U of I introduced a new crop to Illinois farmers, soybeans. Dr. W. L. Burleson, head of the agronomy department, addressed a group of Illinois farmers regarding the university's greenhouse experiment.
We've been experimenting with this new soybean plant, and we've found some startling results. We think it's going to become one of our major crops. But, of course, we can't make it that...
The handful of farmers listened with interest as the speaker explained the advantages that this new crop offered. A good substitute for oats. An emergency hay crop. The fact that the legume plant would also add nitrogen to the soil, which other plants removed, and fit in the rotation with other crops.
We suspect, too, that the plant has possibilities beyond its role as livestock feed. Now, what we'd like is for some of you fellows to put, well, say, 10 acres apiece in soybeans. We'll furnish the seed. You give the crop a chance. Try it for feed and see what you think of it.
During the next few years, soybeans became one of Illinois' most important crops. Not only did the state university promote it as an agricultural crop, but it experimented in the laboratory to develop new uses for the bean. Soybeans for feed and seed, for printer's ink, varnishes and enamels, for linoleum and oilcloth, for plastics and explosives, a waterproof glue, for chocolate bars and cocoa, infant and diabetic foods. Last year, Illinois farmers produced 95 million bushels of soybeans, for which they received about $223 million. $223 million greatly due to the pioneering efforts of a university and its staff, who saw the future for a new and great industry, and the farmers of the state who cooperated in the venture by developing one of Illinois' most important crops. Illinois farmers have looked to the university for many other valuable developments, an antitoxin for botulism, food poisoning, in animals and man, experimental vaccines, expert counsel through extension workers. The basic resource of Illinois is in its rich prairie land, and the soil conservation practices in which the university led the state have helped to develop this land and to preserve it for future generations. For decades, survey and soils test work has aided many individuals in the buying and selling of farmland in Illinois. The University of Illinois College of Agriculture serves the entire state. Looking back now to 1918, some rather startling changes were taking place on the Urbana-Champaign campus. The Armory had become the biggest bedroom in the United States as members of the armed forces were trained and housed here, and the entire university took on an austere wartime aspect. Peace times brought raccoon coats, decrepit cars, and a $2 million stadium as a World War I memorial. In 1922, a young Polish scientist, Joseph Tykociner, spoke to a meeting of the American Institute of Electrical Engineers in the lecture room of the physics building. On the table before him sat the results of 10 months' work at the university and less than $1,000 university dollars. Quite simply, he explained,
"Gentlemen, I've come to show you practical, working, talking motion pictures. With this equipment, I have, for the first time, recorded sound photographically beside the action image. And with this equipment, I shall reproduce that sound in perfect synchronization with the picture. Now, watch. The first is of my wife. You see her now on the screen. Now you'll hear her speak.
I will bring you. Did you hear the bell ringing?
And now you will see and hear Professor Payne, seated before the microphone.
Hello. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. How is it?
The first sound movies were born, and the audience in the physics lab that afternoon were no less amazed than the world. However, the film industry poo-pooed Professor Tykociner's idea, and it was only as a last alternative to save a dying business that one company decided to try a full-length sound picture. By coincidence, the picture was based on a play by a University of Illinois graduate. The graduate, Samson Raphaelson. The picture, The Jazz Singer, starring Al Jolson. Of course, the picture was a success. In fact, it won an Academy Award. But more important, sound movies were a success. Since that time, Samson Raphaelson has become one of the country's outstanding playwrights. Klusman Parks, University of Illinois, class of 36, became Larry Parks, and added another link to the chain between the university and sound movies when he starred in Raphaelson's adaptation of the Jolson story. Joseph Tykociner, the inventor of sound movies, has a few rough reflections about the industry he helped launch.
It was early spring 1922, 29 years ago, when members of the Board of Trustees, led by the president of the university, Dr. Kinley, and vice president, Dr. White, visited my laboratory. I have shown photographic sound recording and photoelectric reproduction of sound in connection with motion picture equipment. On leaving the laboratory, Dr. Kinley, also Dr. Abbott, who I think was chairman of the Board of Trustees at that time, said they were impressed by what they saw and expressed wishes of further success in my work. It was encouraging indeed to hear that. At the time of my first experiments in 1897 and later too, I heard only discouraging remarks. In those very early stages, my attempts were regarded as fantastic. Sound, they said, cannot be photographed. Of no avail were my emphatic explanations that it was not sound proper I was trying to photograph, but light variations produced indirectly sound. My first public demonstration, which took place in June 1922 in the large lecture room of the physics building, convinced those who were present that movies with sound recorded photographically on the film simultaneously with pictures was an accomplished fact. However, I was encountered then with many opinions which expressed a doubt whether the new art of sound pictures will ever be applied. Astonishingly enough, such doubts emanated from quarters one would least expect. Thus, the famous manufacturer of cameras and photographic materials thought sound pictures, no matter how perfect their quality, will never be introduced. When asked what was the basis of his adverse prediction, his answer was brief: the public doesn't want it. And this occurred at a time when the motion picture industry approached a crisis which could be easily interpreted by the fact that the public was tired of silent movies. Many of the visitors who came from the motion picture industry to see my work at the laboratory had grave doubts. Some of them were frightened by the high costs involved in such a revolutionary change in picture production. Others could not imagine how to find stars who could speak with proper voice and diction and act at the same time. There was even one who was hunted by a grave psychological difficulty. One kind of illusion, he thought, is all the human mind could stand. An illusion of sound simultaneously with a visual illusion would be unbearable. Such were the non-technical difficulties which accompanied the introduction of sound movies. It took 6 years since my first public demonstration before all prejudices and fears dissipated.
An aspiring young scientist joined the University of Illinois staff late in the 30s and secured permission to begin work on an invention. It took him 2 years to assemble his machine. Most success stories include years of trial and error, financial failures, and heartache. But on July 15, 1940, Donald W. Kirst turned on his machine for the first time, and it worked. What did it do? It produced X-rays of more than 2 million volts energy, and Kirst called it a betatron. During the past years of research, he's developed his invention to produce 340 million volts. And its uses? Well, here's Professor Kirst in person to describe some of them.
Some of the uses of the betatron have become very practical, but there are other uses which are harder to explain that may bear practical results in the distant future. I'll begin by mentioning the practical uses. First, the medical application employs an intermediate-sized betatron of about 22 million volts. Early tests at the university by Dr. Quassler showed that one could handle the X-rays from a 22 million volt betatron with the same degree of confidence that he could handle the ordinary 200 or 100,000 volt X-rays already used in doctors' offices. He showed that the response of biological specimens to these radiations were not unusual, but he did show that there was a distinct advantage to the dosage distribution of X-rays which you can produce by high-energy betatron radiation. Namely, at 22 million volts, the dose of X-rays is maximum several centimeters beneath the skin of the patient. This has a helpful influence on delivering the destructive dose to a deep tumor. This work has progressed to a high degree in the last few years, and now there are at least two clinical establishments which are using these betatrons on cancer patients with an encouraging degree of success. The second use is a very practical use also. This involves taking X-ray pictures through large metal objects, the usual radiographic use. The radiations from 22 million volt X-rays are more penetrating in iron than are the radiations at any other energy, for example, 100 or 200 kilovolts, which is the usual energy used for radiography. For example, you can take a picture through about 18 or 20 inches of iron in about as many minutes with a 22 million volt betatron. This work is this use is industrial and has been employed in arsenals for some of the examination of large iron and metal military objects. The third use is most difficult to explain because it is really searching for new facts, none of